I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Peter Machinist of Harvard, talking about the Book of Job. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's the sixth day of Passover. Today, the continuation of our great festival of freedom and matzah. Actually, Pesach has four official names in Jewish tradition. Pesach, or Passover, of course, for the paschal offering, the lamb that was sacrificed and roasted in the days of the temple and the Bible. Chag HaMatzot, the holiday of matzah, the unleavened bread we eat for the week of Passover. Chag HaAviv, the springtime festival, probably the oldest of the names of Passover. And most thematically, Zman Chirutenu, the season of our freedom. Each of these names has something important to teach. Each is interesting in and of itself. The word Pesach comes from the word for leaping or jumping in Hebrew, an apt description of the ways that young lambs leap and cavort in the fields. The use of this animal for the sacrifice of the Passover reminds us that the angel of death leaped over the homes of the Israelites when striking the firstborn of the Egyptians, and it also refreshes for us the memory of the leaping joy of freedom, the ability to move and act as we wish that's prevented during slavery. Free people can cavort, if you will, skip or dance or jump as they please. Slaves jump to somebody else's command. Hence, Chag HaPesach, the holiday of, well, skipping. The second name for Passover is Chag HaMatzot, the festival of the poor man's bread, matzah, unleavened bread made with flour and water in less than 18 minutes, baked quickly and simply, food that our ancestors made as preparation for a hasty journey in flight. Of course, on Pesach, we eat matzah all week and therefore do not eat chametz, best described as the opposite of matzah, anything made with leavening or fermentation. That means we're on the sixth day of no bread, no beer, and lots of matzah, and other dishes made out of matzah like kugel or matzah brei. It also means that after 6 days of this, we really understand why matzah is called lechem oni, the bread of affliction. The third name for this festival is Chag HaAviv, the holiday of springtime. Undoubtedly, there was a spring festival observed long before the events of the Exodus led to the creation of this holiday of Passover. Spring is celebrated in every culture and nearly every religion, too. Judaism is no different in that regard. In our Seder celebrations, the orderly meal we held the very first two nights of Pesach that taught the meaning and story of freedom in a rich and wonderful variety of ways, Aviv, spring, was featured in the green vegetables we dipped in salt water and in the hard-boiled egg that symbolized the rebirth of spring. The magnificent love poem, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, was chanted yesterday on the intermediate Sabbath of Passover, Shabbat Chol HaMoed, and it is filled with images of gardens and growth and love in the flowering spring. A wonderful way to celebrate this most beautiful and verdant of seasons. And finally, the ultimate theme of Passover is, of course, freedom. Zman Chirutenu, the time of our liberation. It is this essential ideal that is woven all through this week of Passover, the central focus on God's gift of liberty that has made Pesach the model freedom festival for the whole world. B'chol dor v'dor chayav adam lirot et atzmo ke'ilu hu yatsa mimitzrayim. In every generation, each of us is obligated to see ourselves as though we personally had been brought out of Egypt. In addition to our own celebration of our ancestors' freedom, we learn compassion, even empathy. For when we can view ourselves as survivors of slavery, we are compelled to sympathize with the dispossessed, a central principle of Jewish belief. To play us in on this beautiful spring Pesach morning, here's a mini Passover medley my dad, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, and I recorded, B'chol Dor Vador, in every generation, and Shalach Ami, let my people go.
B'chol Dor Vador, Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo Keilu Yatsa Min Mitzrayim.
That was a Passover medley by my dad, Baruch Kohan, and me for this wonderful holiday of freedom. Passover also lends itself to funny musical cuts. Here's this year's offering, an amusing and slightly terrible version of Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody from Eisha Torah, the Baal Tshuva Orthodox organization. It is called Passover Rhapsody.
Is this the real life? No. To slavery, caught in Pharaoh's vine, no escape to reality.
Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. God will redeem you so miraculously.
'Cause 10 plagues come, then we'll go. Blood and frogs, lice and boils.
Moses, you are dreaming. This could never happen to me.
To me. Pharaoh, let my people go. To fulfill our destiny, with the Torah we'll be free.
Moses, tell your God I've just begun. My heart is hardened. The Hebrews are here to stay.
Pharaoh, what animals running loose?
Soon
you wish you'd never been born at all.
fire and ice, fire and ice.
Plague of hail is coming.
Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Days of darkness.
Days of darkness.
Days of darkness.
Days of darkness.
We cannot see, we cannot move.
Condemn this war crime fiasco.
Listen here, Pharaoh, let my people go.
Who is God? No,
we will not let you go.
Let us go.
Who is God? We will not let you go.
Let us go.
Who is God? We will not let you go.
Let us go.
Will not let you go.
Let us go.
Never let you go.
Let us go.
Angel of death has now taken off the throne.
Moses, can you take us out to the desert to die?
Jump in the water and watch God come out by a high. God did this for us. Egyptians, so we can get out of here.
Ooh, yeah, ooh, yeah. Pass on the revolution.
No, Hametz, we're free.
Time to get the Torah.
Time to get the Torah and be free.
That was Passover Rhapsody by Aish.com with apologies to Queen, although no apologies to the Pharaoh. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning, we'll meet our guest, the outstanding academic and author Peter Machinist of Harvard, exploring the beautiful and complex Book of Job in the Bible. Find out why it's important when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a bid price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help make quality Jewish education available to local students in need of financial support by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO. Here's how it works. Arizona allows taxpayers to receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized organizations like JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to children who attend local Jewish schools in Tucson. These tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you make a contribution to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit, which means that your Arizona state income tax is reduced or your refund is increased up to the amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. You have until April 15th to make your contribution for the 2012 tax year. To foster Jewish education today, give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. Or go online to JETCO.org. By making a tax credit contribution to JETCO, you help nurture Jewish identity in Tucson for new generations of students like me. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish this morning our guest, Peter Machinist. He's the Hancock Professor of Hebrew and Other Oriental Languages at Harvard University. Member of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard, serves in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations, the Harvard Divinity School, the Committee on the Study of Religion, and I'm sure 30 or 40 other committees. University of Zurich, Switzerland, awarded him an honorary doctorate in 2009. He's published on a wide variety of issues involving the Bible and the period of the Bible. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Let's talk a little bit in a cheerful way about the Book of Job, which people know of, but many people don't really read.
Yes, it's a book that I have been teaching in various courses for many years, including the years I spent here in Tucson at the University of Arizona. I tried to characterize it as, on the one hand, a marvelous creation literarily and in terms of its ideas, not only within the corpus of the Bible, but in world literature generally. But at the same time, it's a maddening book to read. It's frustrating on a number of levels. It's mysterious on a number of levels. The language of the bulk of the book is a poetry that we really have very little parallel for elsewhere in the Bible and beyond. The Hebrew is a very strange kind of Hebrew, and therefore the translation of the book is very difficult. The ideas sometimes clash with one another in ways that are hard to put together and clash with other parts of the Bible. You have a man, Job, made to suffer for reasons he doesn't understand, and at one point he gets to the level of saying to God, "You're cruel. You don't know how to discriminate between innocent people and guilty people," something that seems to become awfully close to what we might characterize as blasphemy. The book ends in a funny kind of way. Job, having gone through his trials and asking God repeatedly throughout the book, "Come and explain to me what's going on," finally gets an explanation. God appears in a spectacular storm, but doesn't quite answer the questions in the way that Job had expected. And yet Job submits and says, "Now that I have seen you in the seeing," literally, "whereas before I had heard you in the hearing, I repent and submit to your will." God then goes on to say, "Well, Job, what you have said to me is correct, unlike your friends who spoke to me incorrectly, but were never told exactly what's correct or incorrect." And then God rewards him at the end, gives him back all the things, property and children, that he apparently had lost. And yet this is the greatest irony of all in the book, because the book begins, as many of our listeners will know, with a bet, a wager between God and his chief agent, the Satan, over whether God is being obedient to God without any expectation of a reward. That's the way the Satan puts it. Is Job doing that? Does he expect a reward for being nice and pious to you, or does he not? And at the end, God gives him what looks like a reward, and does that mean that the Satan has won the bet? So the book is full of questions of this kind, and therefore the challenge to us as reading it is not only to marvel at the poetry and the course of the arguments, but to ask, what is it all supposed to say?
Fascinating. We will continue to try to ask the right questions with Peter Machinist when we continue in a few moments on Choo-Choo.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or ekvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also hear past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. You know, every year since he was running for president back in 2008, President Obama has hosted a Passover Seder. For the past 5 years, it's been in the White House. And 2013, 5773, Obama added a new Seder plate given to him by Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu during the president's recent trip to Israel. This Seder tradition began back in 2008 when then-presidential candidate Obama unexpectedly joined a Seder arranged by three young Jewish aides in the basement of a Sheraton hotel in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, during some of the darkest days of his campaign. The organizers were Eric Lesser, who worked on Trip Logistics, campaign videographer Arun Chowri, a past guest of Too Jewish, and Herbie Ziskind, who did campaign advance work. All have since left the Obama team, but came back for last Monday night's Seder. Back in 2008, after the pledge that ends the traditional Seder, L'Shana Haba B'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, candidate Obama raised his glass and declared, "Next year in the White House." At the time, he was still engaged in a ferocious primary battle with Hillary Rodham Clinton. But it turned out just like that. The White House Seders, held in the elegant upstairs family dining room at the White House, blend traditional and new aspects. Untraditionally, the event includes the reading of President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which seems to me highly appropriate. More traditionally, First Lady Michelle Obama lights the festival candles, and the Obama daughters, Malia and Sasha, have taken on the traditional duties of Jewish kids, asking four questions about the purpose of the evening and searching for the matzah that has been hidden at the White House. Apparently, however, the Secret Service is engaged in hiding the Afikoman. Pretty secret. The president's speech last week in Israel revealed that his daughters are a key reason he keeps holding these seders at the White House. "I do so because I want my daughters to experience the Haggadah and the story at the center of Passover that makes this time of year so powerful," Obama said. But there may be an even more personal rationale for the Seder for Obama. During the speech to an audience of young people at the Jerusalem International Convention Center in Israel, the president spoke at length about what the celebration of the Jews' escape from slavery in Egypt means to him. "It's a story of centuries of slavery and years of wandering the desert, a story of perseverance amid persecution, faith in God and the Torah. It's a story about finding freedom in your own land," Obama said, "a story that's inspired communities across the globe, including me and my fellow Americans." The president said the Pesach story has a special resonance to him as an African-American whose early years were not rooted in any one place. "To African-Americans, the story of the Exodus was perhaps the central story, the most powerful image about emerging from the grip of bondage to reach for liberty and human dignity. A tale that was carried from slavery through the civil rights movement into today," he said. "For me personally, growing up in far-flung parts of the world and without firm roots, the story spoke to a yearning within every human being for a home." Pretty good stuff. Either he's got some great Jewish speechwriters or he's figured it out. Obama is the very first president to hold or attend a Seder in the White House. I can't wait now for the rumors to change. The president is no longer a secret Muslim. Now he's a secret Jew. Hey, he could do worse. We welcome back the return of our randomly recurring Haikus for Jews, back for Pesach. "Lacking fins or tail, the gefilte fish swims with great difficulty." And, "On Passover we opened the door for Elijah. Now our cat is gone." That was a Passover version of our Haikus for Jews. For you, a little enlightenment. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Chag Sameach.
Boker Tov, Chag Sameach.
Hope you're enjoying your Passover and the matzah hasn't gotten to you too much so far.
Oh, my God.
We get to end Passover in style here in Tucson, Arizona, with a fantastic celebration called Mimuna. Let's talk a little bit about what Mimuna is and how we do it.
Mimuna traditionally is a holy day that comes on the last day of Passover, when Passover ends. It comes from Moroccan Jews and Algerian Jews and a little bit from Tunisia.
North African Jews.
North African Jews in general. Today it has become a widespread Israeli festival. You can't really be a politician in Israel without going to a Mimuna celebration. It's a big festival, kind of Arabian Nights style with great sweets and you know, all those fun. And it's the first time you can eat chametz.
Right, any kind of real wheat or barley or anything that's made into cakes, you know, the way we love to eat it, which you can't have on Passover.
So here in Tucson, what we are doing at Temple Emmanuel, together with the One Tribe Israel Center, we'll have a huge celebration, a huge party with a Moroccan singer who will bring some Moroccan traditional instruments and play some amazing music to us. Later on, we will learn how to belly dance. We have...
Ooh-ha.
Ooh, yeah, that's cool. And I trust that, Rabbi, you will try to belly dance with us. And we'll have a group of belly dancers that will teach us all the moves and shakes and how to boogie in a belly dance style.
And let's not forget, you know, Moroccan Jewish music is tremendous fun. It's got a great rhythm to it. It really gets everybody up and dancing. And that's because Mamuna comes from North Africa. It was a North African Jewish practice that wasn't necessarily known in the Ashkenazic world.
True. One of the aspects was that during Passover, the Jews at those communities were more observant about the kosher. So along the Passover, they could not go and eat or even visit the houses of their neighbors.
Yeah, because they were probably more kosher than their neighbors. That was sort of the perception.
Exactly. Right? So in order to send the sign or signal that we are still friends, that we are still seeking to be friends with our neighbors, once Passover was over, they would open their house and invite everybody to a big party, a big festival. And that's the idea. It's the idea of opening your house, having everybody come, eat, enjoy life, eat those sweet things, dance together, sing together, have a really good time together. And that's what we're going to do here in Tucson, in Temple Emmanuel. We hope to see you all there.
That's Tuesday night, this Tuesday night at 6 o'clock at Temple Emmanuel.
April 2nd. 6 o'clock, we'll have a great time, really wonderful time.
Sounds very much like fun. Chag Sameach and Tirbachu V'Tisadu, as they say in Morocco. We'll have a wonderful Mamuna together. Chag Sameach, guys. See you then.
Chag Sameach.
Our Jewish poetry slam this morning comes from a poem by the Israeli poet Amnon Ribak. It's called Egypt, and Dr. Wendy Weiss-Kohan will read it.
Every person needs to have his own Egypt, to be Moses himself, in the midst, with a strong hand or with gritted teeth. Every person needs fear and great darkness. Every person needs the fortune to know to raise his eyes to heaven. Every person needs one prayer on the tip of his lips. Every person needs security. Every person needs a protector. Every person needs once to bend or stoop. Every person needs a shoulder. Every person needs his own Egypt to redeem himself from the house of slavery, to go out at midnight into the wilderness of what enslaves him, to step right into the water, to see the waters opening for him to the sides. Every person needs a shoulder to carry on it Joseph's bones. Every person needs to straighten up. Every person needs one long journey to remember forever in the bones of his feet. And every person needs to have his own Jerusalem.
That was Amnon Ribak's excellent poem, Everyone Needs an Egypt. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom. Chag Sameach, Chag Sameach V'Kasher.
Good morning, Rabbi. Mo'adim L'Simcha.
Chagim L'Zmanim L'Sason. It's Passover, the great Freedom Festival. I'm kind of curious. One man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, often in history. You know, I think about that in the context of Moses, who, after all, is a manslaughterer earlier in his career, goes away, comes back, and then has God to help enforce his desire to bring the slaves out, and lots of Egyptians die in the course of that. I'm sure he was not on the Egyptian dollar bill anywhere as a freedom fighter. How does that work internationally?
Right. I think if the Egyptians had used the word terrorist, they might have applied it to
Moses.
Moshe Rabbeinu.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there are obvious other examples. Che Guevara, Castro, for that matter.
Very much so.
Or in terms of European and Jewish history, the Serbian member of the Black Hand, Gavrilo Princip, who shot and killed the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and that was an event that spiraled into World War One, which produced a series of horrible
World
peace
War
treaties,
One, the bad
which
peace
led
sheets.
To the Great Depression, which led to World War II, and
the
Holocaust,
and
all that stuff
that, right.
could be said to have been caused by this one shot. And to this day, Europeans don't agree. In Southeastern Europe, if you are or were a member of a minority that was oppressed by the Habsburgs or the Ottomans or anybody else, this guy was a heroic freedom fighter, and lots of streets and bridges throughout Southeastern Europe are named after this guy. If you were a bureaucrat sitting in Berlin, Vienna, Paris, or London, this guy was clearly a terrorist who committed a terrorist act and needed to be punished.
You know, I was thinking, I mean, to the British, so many of the leaders of the Palmach or the Haganah, the Israeli pre-state, you know, armed group, certainly
right.
Menachem Begin, you know, anybody in the Yishuv who was picking up a gun to fight the British for independence had a price on their heads. They
well, not
hung
to mention our own founding fathers.
Right, right.
Right, who we think of as freedom fighters, but to the British throne, they were terrorists or revolutionaries or whatever.
Both, right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the term is a very judgmental term, but part of the question is, do you agree with the agenda of the freedom fighter? If you do, he or she is a hero and a freedom fighter and, you know, part of a liberation movement. And if you don't agree with the agenda or the objectives, then that person is a terrorist and part of a terrorist movement. So, you know, conveniently, the same person and the same behaviors can be labeled either way, depending on your personal reaction to the agenda.
Very interesting question. In this festival of Chirut, you know, where we're celebrating our Zman HaChirutinu, the season of our freedom, there's a price for freedom, and sometimes people cross interesting lines to get there.
Yeah. I mean, I think, all depends on what your feeling is about the objectives of the person or the movement that is quote unquote fighting for freedom or quote unquote terrorizing the population.
Or both. Thanks, Tom. Happy holiday, and we will see you next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Two Jewish is a public service, especially for Passover. A blind man is sitting on a park bench during Pesach. A rabbi sits down next to him, takes out his lunch, including, of course, some Pesach matzah. Seeing the blind man has nothing to eat and taking pity on him, the rabbi takes a piece of matzah and gives it to the blind man. Several minutes later, the blind man turns, taps the rabbi on the shoulder, and asks, "Who wrote this garbage?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You see, the blind man thought the matzah was actually something written in Braille. You know, matzah's bumpy and... never mind. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion, the first after Passover's over, is Shmini, and it includes a dramatic and traumatic event. The tabernacle in the wilderness has just been consecrated, and the priests, Moses' brother Aaron and his sons, are entering into their office. The Shekhinah, God's presence, fills the tabernacle, and all is good with the people. And then, suddenly, disaster strikes. Aaron's eldest sons, newly ordained priests named Nadav and Avihu, offer what is called a shezarah, strange fire, to the Lord. They are immediately struck down and devoured by fire, dying before God. In the aftermath of this tragic shock, Moses consoles Aaron with strange words. God says, "By those brought near to me, I am consecrated and honored before the people." Bikrovai Ekadesh. There is no word on whether Aaron accepted this as somehow a just ending for his beloved sons. The text merely says, "Vayidom Aharon." Aaron was silent. We don't know the young priest's offense, if any. We are not told what strange fire was. God decrees, atonement offerings are made for whatever sins they may have committed, and the people are restored to God's favor. Calamity happens, and then we go on. We also don't know why certain tragedies take place in our lives, or why terrible things sometimes happen to good people. As Ben Sirach says in the text Ecclesiasticus from the Apocrypha of the Hebrew Bible, we have been shown more than we can understand. We do know that Aaron's silence may be the only real response to profound tragedy and loss. And our comfort may come only when we silently acknowledge our own powerlessness. This may seem small comfort, but it is also an honest appraisal of our ability to comprehend profound loss. May God keep each of us from tragedy, but may God also give us the strength that Aaron had when we have to face loss, the ability to accept the painful inadequacy of our own explanations with dignity and courage. When we come back on Too Jewish, archaeologist, author, and Harvard professor Peter Machinist will explore how Job deals with those kinds of questions and what he can teach us about our own lives now, when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia. Surprise.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, in a reconciliation of two close U.S. allies, in part arranged by President Obama during his recent visit to Israel, Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu apologized to Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan for operational mistakes during the 2010 raid on a Turkish flotilla headed for Gaza, the Mavi Marmara incident. An announcement, the two nations resuming normal diplomatic ties, quickly followed. Good. The incident that turned Turkish-Israeli ties into a full-blown fight came in May of 2010 when Israeli forces confronted a flotilla of six ships which attempted to breach Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip controlled by the terrorist Hamas. The Israeli commandos were attacked when they boarded one of the ships, the Mavi Marmara. They responded with deadly force. Nine people were killed, all of them Turks, one a dual U.S.-Turkish citizen. The incident marked the nadir of Turkey-Israel ties, a negative sea change in a close operational and military relationship that had seen Israel and Turkey as allies for a number of years. After the raid, Turkish Islamist Prime Minister Erdogan suspended defense agreements with Israel and barred Israeli planes from flying through Turkey's airspace. Over the last 3 years, Erdogan has blamed Jewish control of the media for anti-Turkish bias. And suggested as recently as last month that Zionism is a crime against humanity. But this week he backpedaled from all of that. It remains to be seen whether last week's Israeli apology will bring a real end to the years of growing Turkish hostility to Israel that have coincided with Erdogan's tenure. But it is a good start at any rate. Last week, the new Pope Francis I sent a Passover message to the chief rabbi of Rome, Riccardo de Segni. It read in part, "I take great pleasure in extending my warmest best wishes to you and Rome's entire Jewish community on the occasion of the great feast of Pesach. May the Almighty, who freed his people from slavery in Egypt to guide them to the promised land, continue to deliver you from all evil and to accompany you with his blessing. I ask you to pray for me, as I assure you of my prayers for you, confident that we can deepen our ties of mutual esteem and friendship." Signed, Francis. Very nice start to this papacy, no? In other symbolic news, the Arab League last week approved a Qatari proposal to set up a billion-dollar fund for Arab East Jerusalem, which Palestinians want to be the capital of an independent state, under a perhaps eventual peace deal with Israel. Qatar's emir, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, said his country will contribute $250 million to the fund, which he called for in an opening speech to an Arab summit in Doha, focusing on the crisis in Syria and the stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace efforts. The summit calls for setting up a fund to support Jerusalem to the value of $1 billion to finance projects and programs that will maintain the Arab and Islamic character of the city and reinforce the steadfastness of its people, the resolution said. The Islamic Development Bank, based in Saudi Arabia's Red Sea city of Jeddah, will manage the fund. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas welcomed the fund to help protect the Arab character of Jerusalem and urged Arab states to contribute to it. The Israeli occupation is working in a systematic and hurried way to Judaize East Jerusalem, change its features, uproot its Palestinian inhabitants, attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its Muslim and Christian holy sites, Abbas said in a non-factual speech at the summit. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Yigal Palmor said the initiative was a badge of shame for Qatar. Objecting to the Judaization of Jerusalem, so to speak, is absurd. It's equitable to an objection to the Catholic nature of the Vatican or the Islamization of Mecca. It is naturally unthinkable, Palmore said. Palestinian officials are skeptical of these huge Arab aid pledges. Few Arab countries have carried through on their promises last year to cover a Palestinian funding gap. Last year, Arab donations, including $200 million from Saudi Arabia, constituted almost half of the Palestinian Authority's foreign aid, with the U.S. and the European Union providing about $330 million. As we've seen many times before, unfortunately, decisions in Arab summits do not materialize on the ground, said Ghassan Shaka, a senior member of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Financing is just a means. Political help is the important thing. The Arab world must convince and apply pressure so the world knows what's required for peace. He did not, of course, say exactly what it was that was required for peace. And finally, a wonderful story about the preservation of memory and nature from Amsterdam all the way to America. Saplings from the chestnut tree that stood as a symbol of hope for Anne Frank when she hid from the Nazis for 2 years in Amsterdam are now being distributed to 11 locations in the U.S. as part of a project aiming to preserve her legacy and promote tolerance. The tree, one of the Jewish teenager's only connections to nature when she hid with her family, was diseased and rotted through the trunk when wind and heavy rain toppled it in August of 2010. But saplings grown from its seeds will be planted starting in April, when the Children's Museum of Indianapolis gets to put the first one in the ground. The 11 U.S. locations also include a park memorializing September 11th victims in New York City, an Arkansas high school that was the heart of the desegregation battle, and Holocaust centers in Michigan and Washington State. All of those 11 locations were chosen by the Anne Frank Center USA from 34 applicants. Winners were selected based on their commitment to equality, demonstration of the consequences of intolerance or historical significance to civil rights and social justice, and other qualities. The heart of our mission is tolerance. Tolerance is really essential for being able to bring better welfare to everybody, said Center spokesman Mike Clary. The tree is referenced several times in the diary that Anne Frank kept during the 25 months she remained indoors until her family was arrested by the Nazis in August of 1944. Nearly every morning I go to the attic to blow the stuffy air out of my lungs, she wrote on February 23, 1944. From my favorite spot on the floor, I look up at the blue sky and the bare chestnut tree, on whose branches little raindrops shine, appearing like silver, and at the seagulls and other birds as they glide on the wind. A global campaign to save the chestnut was launched in 2007 after city officials deemed it a safety hazard and ordered it taken down. The tree was granted a last-minute reprieve after a court battle, but age and nature ultimately brought it down. And now its children will flourish at important sites of tolerance all around our nation. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, the outstanding Professor Peter Machinist, the Hancock Professor of Hebrew and Other Oriental Languages at Harvard University, member of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard, serves in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations, the Harvard Divinity School, and the Committee on the Study of Religion, received an honorary doctorate from the University of Zurich, Switzerland. He has many publications, and we are talking about the really challenging question of the Book of Job and suffering. You know, earlier today, Peter, earlier this morning, we talked about the possibility of decoupling suffering from actual punishment for having done something wrong. Sometimes it just stinks, whether you've acted well or acted badly. And it always seems to me that Job is a perfect example of this, and the friends who come serially to comfort him, some comfort, don't get this.
That's very true. As you read the exchanges between the friends and Job in the course of a number of chapters in the book, the exchanges become increasingly angry. They start throwing all kinds of charges against one another, such that in the third and final round of exchanges, the book itself seems to fall apart as a literary creation. Suddenly Job is saying things that the friends have said. One of the friends doesn't even come around in the third round, and it looks as if, quite deliberately, the conversation is made to fall apart because these sorts of rational explanations, suffering has to be a punishment, just are seen finally not to work. And then comes a chapter, it's chapter 28 in the book, which is a kind of intermezzo, a kind of moment of standing back from the dialogue and asking what has happened. And it's a chapter about what wisdom is. And the point of the chapter is, wisdom doesn't belong to human beings. A human being can't find it. It's not a matter of increasing technological expertise. Wisdom is finally, says the chapter, fearing God. And the word fear in biblical Hebrew tends to mean obedient, pious.
Awe.
And this, I think, underlines the beginning of an explanation that the Book of Job is striving toward to explain suffering. It uses, I think, wisdom on three levels. There's the wisdom of Job and his other human associates, his friends who come to talk with him. There's the wisdom of us as readers, human readers. We know certain things at the beginning that Job doesn't know. We know about the bet between God and the Satan. Job doesn't know about that. And then finally, there is the wisdom of God himself. And the text is playing off these different wisdoms. At one point, we as readers think we're superior to Job because we know something. But then toward the end, when God appears and the issue comes, what kind of phenomenon, what kind of power is this God? Where does he operate? What is his purpose? We suddenly realize we don't know any more than Job does about this. And so,
isn't that really the message of Job?
We
just don't get God?
Yes, I think the first thing that the book is trying to tell us is that human wisdom, whether of Job and his friends or of us as readers, has its limits. And the first property of human wisdom is to know its own limits. But you don't find out what these limits are until you struggle. You have to go through the struggling of testing, which Job is made to do. The divine wisdom, the third category that I mentioned, begins to be revealed, if you will, when Job comes out of this whirlwind, this storm.
The Shoah, where the term comes from, of course.
Yeah. To talk about the universe and to make the point, first, that there are realms of this universe that human beings can't imagine, let alone control. But then also, as a number of my colleagues have pointed out, to say that, Job, you are, because you don't know this whole universe, you are incompetent to ask questions of me. The language here is legal. There's a lot of legal language in the book. You are incompetent to appear in a court setting and to accuse me of being cruel. In other words, there may be a system of justice operative. The book by no means disallows that.
But you don't have the bona fides to show up at this court as a
right.
as an attorney.
That's correct. So once you realize that, then what is the human response? That it knows that it can't know everything, and that things like suffering pose the question of what it doesn't know, of what human beings don't know. I think this is the last message of the book in some way, that acceptance is the order of the day. You have to know when it's time to give in. And I found here, I didn't bring it with me this morning, a wonderful eulogy for a great friend of mine in whose synagogue I was a member, Rabbi Daniel Jeremy Silver in Cleveland, Ohio, who was not only a great congregational rabbi, he was also a member of the Department of Religion at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, where I taught before I came to Arizona. He died as a young man. He was a very powerful-looking man physically and with a very powerful mind. Brain cancer felled him when I think he was 61. And I couldn't go to his funeral, but one of his own rabbinical friends, Rabbi Samuel Karf of Texas, gave a beautiful eulogy with exactly this point, that Dan Silver, as long as he could, fought with all his might against his disease. But when the time came, he knew how to die. He knew how to accept the decree of the Almighty, I think is the way Rabbi Karf put it. But you don't get to that level of acceptance, says the book of Job, without a struggle. And the struggle is Job's struggle to find out what the limits of his wisdom are and to challenge God at least to come and explain something. Even if that something is not what Job initially had expected, it's an explanation that I think says these are the dividing lines. This is what you as a human being can do. This is what you as a human being must accept, but not allow that acceptance to wipe out everything that you have done and can do.
I want to thank Peter Machinis for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Thanks so much, Peter.
My pleasure to be with you, and good luck.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be a fascinating Israeli woman who lives in the shadow of rocket attacks and yet works for peace, Roni Kidar. Our playout this morning comes from Safam, the Jewish folk rock classic group. It's a version of the Passover psalm, Betzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, when Israel came forth from Egypt. My friends, a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and kosher Passover, and a Zisen Pesach. May you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Betzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, Bet Yaakov Me'am Elohez, Hayta Yehuda Likadsho, Yisrael Mamshilo. Malecha hayam kitanus hayar.